Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjee. I'm Svetlana.
And I'm Ben.
In season 2, we will be traveling around the globe, out of Switzerland, and bring amazing leaders from businesses, thought leaders, political leaders, of course, investors and experts.
We're working at implementing and realizing all the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, better known as SDGs.
And they are also making profit.
Hello, I am Amina Gurifakim, and I'm the sixth president of the Republic of Mauritius.
My name is Parvati, and I'm a musical artist and the founder and CEO of Parvati Foundation.
I'm Michael Lichtenstein. I'm an entrepreneur here in Lichtenstein. I'm running on one side of financial services, a company.
You know, hundreds of deals a month, we are seeing more things happening in this impact world. And this is because, look, the world is changing.
So join us to discover impact investing ecosystem.
See you every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central European time at Swiss Impact with Banerjee.
See you on Friday. Act with impact.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone, and especially from the viewers from Far East. Good night.
Welcome, welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjee. And today we are at our sixth week of season 2. And for those who are new, in this show, we are talking to global leaders, policymakers, experts, academics on the topic of impact investment and impactful businesses. Moreover, we want to inspire you and raise awareness about impact investing, about global challenges, and more importantly, get you into action. We want to get you engaged in the topic of impact investing. And it doesn't matter who you are, expert, investor, newcomer, any profession would fit well. So we want to invite you to our show today.
Thank you very much. So I want to start with a message to all of you. So I think many of you know that I lost my sister a couple of weeks back to COVID in India. So in her memory, we started a project called Project Joya to support the poor and the underprivileged in India. And a lot of help at this moment is reaching. Unfortunately, it's not reaching the rural area. So our project is mainly focused on supporting them in rural areas. You can read more in detail about our project at the same website as Camomile, that is camomile.ch, and look for Project Joya, Help India Against COVID. All your help in every way, every form is most welcome.
Yes, absolutely. So you can donate from 10 francs up to 50,000 francs for those who have the opportunity. I invite you all to be generous and support humans who are in need right now. And Ben, before you ask me, maybe I should quickly talk about our course, which is coming ready next week. Wow. So 20th of May, we will have two courses on profitable business with impact. It's about how to create or grow the existing business, how to transform it to impact investing, right? So how can you create both social and environmental impact and at the same high return? How do you structure your business in this way so you can be successfully with fundraising and get impact investors on board? How to get other support, expertise, and funds available for your impactful business. So join us. I hope you were quick enough to make the picture to get the link. Otherwise, just go to Camomile. Thank you very much. Camomile.ch to events, and you find both of the time slots at 12:30 and 19:30 Central European time. So we're looking forward to welcome you next week. Ben, do you have anything to say or share
a
story?
I just wanted to say that Camomile is camomile.ch because sometimes the computer catches in a different way.
It's a CH one, right? CH Camomile.
Exactly. Today I have no story because it's extremely interesting panel. And it's an extremely interesting day. And it's one of our favorite topic, agriculture.
Yay!
I just wanted to say one of my friends, Idar, he's the head of the largest financial institution of Norway, who mentioned that while we blindly are focusing regarding climate change on technology and finance, because hoping that these two will help us get to the goals of the Paris Agreement, we forget one of the most important pillars, and that is people.
And people can create, and they are creating tremendous impact. And one of the main impacts is actually eating habit. So as per some research article that I read, we can solve the whole climate change issue with just a simple change in our habit, like eating meat. Yes, it's uncomfortable truth, I know. And it's not only one of the greatest CO2 emissions emitters, but also the cause of dead zones in the oceans and main cause of destruction of ancient rainforests like Amazon and Indonesia.
So today is basically Svetlana's day. So I just stay in the back, because she's a vegan and has very, very strong opinion on meat industry. So as that you will be driving post today's discussion and your stories and opinion. So with this, we welcome our guests of today.
Yes, welcome. Welcome. We have three guests today, and I would be happy to introduce each of them once they appear here in our studio. 1, 2, 3. Yay! Welcome, Jerome. Hi. Hello. Welcome, Helena. Hello, hello.
Hi.
And ta-da! Welcome, Amina. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So it's amazing to have you guys with us today. And for those who don't know you, I will be just briefly giving a short background of yours. So we are honored, of course, to welcome our very special guest, the sixth president of the Republic Mauritius, Her Excellency Professor Dr. Amina Grieb-Fakim. And she is not only a political leader, but she's also a scientist and a leader on the topic of agriculture, climate change, and woman empowerment in Africa. So welcome, Amina.
Thank you.
The second guest is Mr. Jerome Remmers. And next to being Ben's childhood friend, which I learned recently, he is the director of the TAP Coalition, an international foundation focusing on fair prices and taxes. Yeah, dangerous topic today, taxes on meat. And to make the production and consumption of meat and dairy sustainable. His foundation is supported by farmers, healthcare professionals, youth, businesses, and charities.
I'm very curious how he got the support of the farmers, but we will
I don't
hear
know.
From him
I
later.
I don't know. We will ask you that. And the report which Jerome produced called Aligning Food Prices with the European Green Deal, and another report, Sustainability Charge on Meat, which is presented at the EU Parliament in 2020, just in February. And then he got actually the support and could influence EU Commission Farm to Fork strategy that in a way that already in April 2020, the Dutch Parliament accepted or included it into governmental proposals. Congratulations, Jerome, on these achievements.
It's still a proposal. It still has to be ratified.
Yeah, I know. And of course, thirdly, Mrs. Helena Wright, Policy Director at FAIR Institute. Dr. Helena Wright is Policy Director, and she's based in London, where she focuses on policy solutions related to the risks and opportunities surrounding intensive animal agriculture. I really like this topic, so we'll talk more about that. Helena's work focuses on engaging with governments, regulation, industry bodies, and investors to promote greater understanding of the ESG risks, so environmental, social, governmental risk, surrounding intense animal agriculture, and build increased engagement around sustainable policies and business practices. Welcome, Helena, to the Swiss Impact with Banerjee's. Welcome to all of you guys. Can we start now?
Yeah, you can. Today, I'll just follow the lead.
No. You invited all the guests for me to torture them, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, all right. So ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to start with a very, very simple question. And it's so simple, I'm sure you can answer. Are you vegan or vegetarian? And why or why not?
I think now we lose all our guests.
So, well, maybe who would I like to start? Yes.
Yes, I can start. I'm nearly vegetarian. I eat some meat, only a little bit, and mostly organic. So that's my answer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And why?
Because
and why not completely vegetarian? What stops you from that?
Yeah, I've been a vegetarian for I think 8 years, but then I started a little bit, but as for also my views, we as a top coalition, we like to have a true fair price on meat, and we don't say you have to stop eating meat at all. Of course, mm-hmm. it would be helpful for the environment, but we say if we eat meat, then let's pay a fair price, including the environmental cost of it. And then meat will become 40% more expensive. But then we pay the true price, which covers all cost of it. So that's why I eat a little bit meat. So I can also tell people, you can eat meat, but then
he has to be careful with his answers. Well, you never know who in Netherlands is listening.
Maybe at the end of the show, we will help you a little bit. Okay, but thanks for your honest answer, Jerome. Ladies, who'd like to answer this little question?
Well, I can have a go.
Yeah.
I eat less and less meat, and the reason for this is purely for, I think, health reason. And you know, now that we have more alternatives in Mauritius, so it is possible to eat less meat and more towards seafood, and that's it, more vegetable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so health reasons. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And Helena?
Yeah, I'm happy to go next. I'm mainly plant-based, but actually, I mean, that's mainly for environmental reasons and also ethical reasons, I'd say, as well. So animal welfare. But yeah, I think it's a very personal topic for a lot of people. But yeah, I would say sort of moving more and more in the plant-based direction, personally.
Thank you.
Well, we are not done yet. What about you?
Oh, I'm a I'm vegetarian. Once in a while, if I'm outside, I eat meat, very little. But since last couple of days, I'm trying to start with vegan. So let's see how I succeed. But on the other hand, if I make up my mind, I always manage. So that's
true. So I'm really happy for this. Before we go to the questions, guys, what I'd like to ask you is about contribution of agriculture to climate change, because there are many various reports and statistics out there. So to bring everyone on the same page, that we are not arguing about how much agriculture contributes to climate change. So for example, as per my knowledge, or based on some statistical reports, animal agriculture is responsible for 18% of greenhouse gas emissions, which is actually more than the combined exhaust from all transportation. Would you agree to this number, or are you having other numbers as your base?
My numbers is that it's less than that. It's about, it hovers between 10 to 12%. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the other panelists have in terms of numbers, but I think the biggest polluters, it's not maybe agriculture, but there are others quite high on the list. And here we all know the fossil fuel industry, the garment industry, and the shipping industry are among the biggest polluters. So mm-hmm. agriculture, I think we have to be a bit fair. It's not that much, but if 12% is perceived to be high, then yes, we need to be addressing that as well in terms mm-hmm. of emissions.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think I've seen figures that it's around between 14 and 15%, actually. That's from the mm-hmm. FAO, UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of broader figure, which includes the whole food supply chain, which would be larger.
Right.
So often, I think it depends what you're including in those figures mm-hmm. as well.
Oh. In general?
Yes. I heard indeed the number of 18%, but sometimes you also see 20 to 25%, and it's depending on what you account in it, like the land use effects of deforestation, is this included or not, etc. So that can make the percentages more higher.
Okay. Yeah. So we basically have a range from 12 to 25%, and I mean, it's quite high, right? This is why it's important to talk about it, and this is why our show dedicated to this topic.
Exactly.
Ben, now it's your turn.
So we all come that agriculture is a very, very important part. So I think I'll ask this first question is, so the global consumption, as you know, is especially in the meat and dairy industry is increasing. It is increasing, especially also if you look at China or countries where more and more people are coming in the middle class, from poor to middle class or upper middle class, the meat consumption and dairy consumption is increasing, which on other hand is conflicting with the goals of the Paris Agreement. So what would be your opinion? How can we kind of counteract it? How can we see to it that the Paris Agreement's goals do not get impacted negatively by the increasing meat and the dairy products? So Jeroen, if you want to go ahead, since it's...
Yes, maybe it's good to introduce a slide where we can see some of the figures of the increasing consumption of meat and the impact on climate change. So sheet one, please.
Sheet one, okay.
Yes. So on the left side, you see the consumption of meat, which is projected in the future. So the orange yellow figures is the growth in the different countries. So it will be higher in the future. It's growing with 2% per year on average. So and on the right side you can see what this means. So you see, in 2016, the greenhouse gas emissions from meat and dairy were 14%. So we just discussed it. So this is now. But in the future, when fossil fuels will go down, but meat and dairy consumption will go up, then the relative impact of the greenhouse gas emissions from meat and dairy will grow. So in 2050, it can become nearly 50% of all the greenhouse gas emissions in the world, which would be crazy, of course, that our food consumption and with only those two products will lead to so much greenhouse gas emissions. So I think we really should do something with this problem, and I think taxing a product is the most effective way to do such things.
and Dr. Amina, what do you think?
Eating meat, well, we know that it's a very important source of protein, and there have been many comparative studies which have been done to show that the amount of protein that goes into the diet coming straight from meat is up to a certain point. And I think here, if we are going to address the issue of climate change and then link it up to food habits, we will have a big challenge, because a lifestyle is changing. And as you know, that of course, we have to really address this prior to COVID, because right now we really have to rethink our approach. But it is very much a status symbol as well. And we have seen that emerging countries, eating meat now is no longer a luxury. It is now part of everyday diet. And so it is very much part of lifestyle. And if we are going to be addressing this in a sustainable manner, then we will have to look at the whole entire agricultural sector into a sector which is more sustainable. And there are many, many ways of doing it. And I think in the course of the conversation, we will see how it is not easy when we look at interest, which come into the picture. But there are many, many ways of addressing agriculture, make it more sustainable, and look at ways such as regenerative agriculture, but here it's an entire big debate as to how you make regenerative agriculture become the main, the main way. And right now it is still marginal, but we know that with the right incentives and with the right approach, and of course addressing the needs of smallholder farmers, we will have a way of balancing the need, the demand, and also at the same time address the climate change issue, because we know that regenerative agriculture is a very good way of absorbing carbon as opposed to emitting carbon. So these are things that we will have to address in our conversation, and I'm sure that we will be able to address the demand as well as the supply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Helena, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that we're going to see governments more and more acting on this issue actually in the years ahead. And actually, I just wanted to mention our report last year, which looked at the topic of the livestock levy. And actually, there seems to be lots of parallels in terms of other products such as, you know, tobacco, sugar, and also carbon, where in the past, there wasn't much regulation on those products. But in the future, I think we're going to see, with the concerns about climate change, more focus on this issue over time. So this is an issue for investors as well. So I'm here today to really point out that we are seeing increasing momentum on this topic. Policy is actually moving in the direction of really internalizing the costs to society of the overconsumption of animal protein.
Yeah, thank you. And Jerome?
Yes, I agree what Helena said about the increasing expectations that about governments who will put a price on the impacts of meat and dairy consumption. You see that already in New Zealand, meat and dairy was included into their emission trading scheme starting in 2025. So they have to pay for the greenhouse gas emissions they create. And in Germany, there's a debate about a tax on meat and dairy. But this will be used to use the revenue of the tax to pay farmers for better animal welfare. And in the Netherlands, it's the same. So there are more and more countries involved in preparing legislation and taxation for those sectors. And I think this will also impact investors in those sectors, because they could become a smaller sector as a result of those taxes. Yes, I hear some silence. So,
yes, you mentioned the carbon tax, and you've mentioned the issue of tax generally. And in parallel, we also have to look at subsidies, right? And these are all very, very loaded words, taxes and subsidies. And if we are going to apply taxes, we have stalled in Mauritius the tax on sugar products, right? And we know that sugar, ever since it's been discovered, has created a lot of havoc in the world, right? It started initially with slavery, and now we see how it's impacting health directly through overconsumption of sugar. But there's something that I think we have to bring into the fold as well, is when we talk about sugar, when we talk about animal fats and animal meat, we also have to really look at it from the segment of the population. And if you go to countries like in some sub-Saharan African countries, you find that poorer people, they tend to become more obese. And because they are the biggest consumers of sugary stuff, of sugary product and animal fats. And you find that those people who can afford it, they have more varied diet, they will be, you know, less, there will be less tendency for them to consume, a kind of finished product, finished food, high in sugar, high in fat and all that. So there is already a social issue which has to be addressed. And when we look at taxation, right? We have to really talk about incentivization of those farmers that can make products, that can make food crops, which are affordable, which are nutritious. So there is a dimension of education that has to be brought in, and a dimension of extension services which have to be brought in, so that these people can know what are the alternatives. And if we are going to provide, if you're going to actually go with the taxation route, the other issue that we all have to see is who benefits. Where are the incentives for those people to produce better, to produce more, and to produce quality? And this brings us back again to, you know, to big discussion that we can have, be it at the level of the European Union, be it at the level of the Americans, you know, all the major players. When we talk about taxes, we talk about subsidies, especially subsidies, who stands to gain, right? Yeah. And this is where we have to bring in institutions like the WTO. I mean, if you want to create a level playing field, if only for the ag sector, I mean, reactivate the dispute settlement so that, you know, we can have a sector which works for one and all. And this is not what we're seeing right now. And we have seen how the big players use the weight, use the muscle, and to just throw the weight around and trample on all the others who are able to actually make a living out of agriculture, be it through, you know, incentive that they can get through trade or incentive that they can get through subsidies. So this is a discussion that must be had because it will directly impact this sector. And we also see how corporate sector weigh in into this balance and prevent even smallholders, because we're talking increasing about tax credit. Now, who is it working for? I can tell you it is not working for the smallholder farmers. And yet these are the people we have to help. So these are some, sorry, I can get very passionate about this.
It's a very, very good point. Thank you very
much.
This
is why we are here, you know, I mean, to discuss exactly, to bring the big elephants into the room, make them visible.
Just go ahead, Helena.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a point to that, which is that some of our investors have recently brought out a statement on the need to align agricultural subsidies with the climate change goals. And that statement was actually calling on the EU to better reform its subsidies, actually, to enable the climate change goals to be possible. And that's actually quite important in that statement. And that called for a just transition as well for the farmers, to support them to a more sustainable form of agriculture. So we are seeing investors sort of calling now for these reforms to be taken as well, in light of the fact that a lot of these investors have obviously made commitments towards tackling climate change. And we now need policymakers to make that possible as well.
I just wanted to add for the viewers that Dr. Amina represents or is speaking on behalf of not only Mauritius, but she's extremely knowledgeable and speaking on behalf of Africa. Jerome, on the other hand, is advising and is also busy with the EU Commission. And Helena, she represents an organization whose members have some ridiculous amount of $34 trillion.
It's actually 38 trillion now.
38 trillion. So you have a big, big clout, and you can make a big influence.
Yes.
Financially.
Yes. So. And you know, Ben, we're talking, as we are at it, we're talking about agriculture. I think so far we have touched on food crops because we are addressing the issue of meat. But there is another sector for agriculture which touches on the garment industry, cotton. And that's, again, a very, very loaded question in terms of, you know, the weight of subsidies that go into the cotton sector and how this is distorting the entire, chewing the entire trade. When it comes to farmers in West Africa, they can go to the WTO, but how can they leverage against a big player like the United States if you go through the WTO and the dispute settlement? So, I mean, all these things have to be addressed because all these, one way or the other, they will impact the contribution of greenhouse gas to the debate that we're having today.
And, you know, this is exactly the question, you know, that one of the biggest subsidies after fossil fuels is agricultural sector. So the subsidies are going to this sector. And the question is, how are you guys advocating to remove this subsidy, you know,
or tie it
to sustainable agriculture? Yeah. Because it would be definitely very unpopular for such countries like France to remove such subsidies. So are you
now Jerome gets very
very smiley, yeah.
Yes, I think the idea that we have as a TAP coalition and one of our partners are farmer organizations, and that is that we propose to use revenues of meat taxes and also dairy taxes to give it back partly for 50% to the farmers. So, and this can be done especially to farmers with smallholder farmers, but organic farmers who have carbon farming at their lands, mm-hmm. to store CO2 in the ground. It can be biodiversity, nature production combined with farming, and we need a lot of money for those kinds of sustainable farming. So we propose that all the subsidies Dutch farmers receive from the European Union will be doubled by those revenues from the meat taxes. So that means that consumers, they have to pay more for food, yes, but the farming methods will be more sustainable, more environmental friendly, more animal welfare.
Jerome, you can show that video, I think, where these numbers are shown very clearly, how the subsidy would be used.
Yes.
I can ask if the video is shown.
That was...
Okay, that explains. I just wanted to say, because I'm also with the Climate Leadership Coalition, and we are now very much active with the carbon pricing. That's a very strong topic at this moment, because we also worked at the policy of the Green Deal and everything. And what is your opinion about carbon pricing of food products on the meat, because
and dairy, not only meat but also dairy
product, yeah, because the meat, the agriculture and the dairy is also producing a lot of CO2. Mm-hmm. So what would be your opinion? And this I think is also valid for Africa, that would you consider or would you think about putting carbon pricing or including carbon pricing with the agriculture?
You know, again, Ben, whenever these, I'm not a diplomat. Huh? I may have been a president, but I'm not a diplomat. I will say that straight away. All these issues, which are, you know, all these policies that we have floating around, these sectors, which are very key sectors, they tend to favor the big producers. Right? Mm-hmm. They tend to favor, because I think all the calculations have been done in such a way that when you talk about carbon pricing, all these looks very, very, very interesting, very nice on paper. Put it in practice. You find that many, many, many organizations will tend to pull the carpet over themselves or the sheet on themselves, right? What is left for the smallholder farmer? Because to me, as somebody who is in Africa, and of course here I have to open a parenthesis, Africa, again, there is no one size fits all, because Africa is missed the Green Revolution. Africa, has 60% of the world arable land, but Africa is still rain-fed agriculture. right? So, and we have seen the very linear method that have been applied. You buy your seed, you plant it, and you adopt, you put in, of course, all the fertilizers which have been made by, you know, the petroleum, well, products of the petroleum industry, the fossil fuel industry, and you will get a yield of sort. This model has been applied, and recently there has been an evaluation. They have seen that it doesn't work. Right? The results are not as has been anticipated. So what do we do for the farmer in Africa who is now depending on rain when we know climate change is impacting? So when we talk about the working out of the formula for carbon, right, pricing, come on, let us be serious. Is it going to work for the small farmers who have the potential? Because if you look at permaculture, if you look at agroforestry, if you look at well, agriculture, as we have known it in the past, which have been marginalized. I mean, let us do the calculation. If you look about, if you're going to talk about taxes, yes, let us tax, but make sure that the tax goes back to these groups that need it and that can make a difference. I mean, let us do the trial. And you're talking about some of our panelists who are custodians of trillions of dollars. Let us try out. I'm a scientist, so I go by results. Let us do it. Let us work out a scheme where these farmers can be supported by whatever, and look at the carbon emission. If this can be worked out, this can easily be worked out. But at the end of the day, we're going to have to, especially as we move out of the COVID, look at ways of ensuring food security. Already in Africa, if you're interested in trillion, we are sitting on a $1 trillion business. But how do we do it? With, well, techniques, with technology, which is absent, but we know that all the resources are there, we can make a difference. But how do we do it? And how do we price it in such a way that the small farmers stands to gain? So this is the question that we have to be asking a lot of the time. How do we make it work for the smaller actors?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that, you know, because it's usually the big guys who are taking the credit or maybe damaged a little bit, but it's always the poor guys who are paying, you know. It's the same with COVID. Also, it's the poor people who are suffering the most. It's with everything. Yeah. I mean, in many countries, it's like
it's,
that.
It's the weak. And that's, I would like to ask, because, Amina, you mentioned a very strong point, and I would like to ask this to Helena, because Helena, you have a kind of global idea about what's going on in Africa, in West Europe, in America. What would be your statement to what Amina just mentioned?
Yeah, well, I think one of the interesting things that we've been doing with the investors is looking at climate scenario analysis for the agriculture sector. And I think that can be a very helpful tool to look at the investment portfolios and how a carbon price would affect those portfolios. And one of the things that we found using the modeling is that actually, if you look into the future, diversification into sustainable protein is a really good way to reduce a lot of those risks, not just kind of the climate risk, but actually there's benefits for a wide range of risks, including biodiversity risk, water risk, etc., and so on, because obviously animal agriculture uses up a lot of water, a lot of resources, and a lot of energy as well. So for a wide range of benefits, what we're seeing is that diversification is really the way forward, and sustainable protein will be, I think, a key lever and a key tool to actually support all of the sustainable development goals, actually. And in fact, one of our previous reports pointed out that in terms of food security as well, the amount of animal feed that's currently going to livestock, instead of going to people, also means that the current kind of overconsumption of meat and dairy sector and the amount of support that that sector is producing is also negative for food security. So, yeah, I think we can see a bit of, you know, consensus building now about the need to diversify and have more focus on sustainable protein.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And one thing as well, sorry, can I just respond to what has just been said? Yes. We're talking about biodiversity. There's one thing as well, which is a very contentious issue in Africa, and I think this was the same thing at some point in India as well, is sustainability of seed production. And there has been a lot of movement to actually impose imported seed. And we have seen a lot of resistance, and I think we saw the movement in India as well, on farmers wanting to have their own seeds. And one thing we have seen also in Africa is that we should not be neglecting the indigenous biodiversity. And in terms of, well, if you're going to talk about sustainable practices for farming, and we also have to consider the indigenous flora and indigenous plants, which have the potential. I think these are, again, backed by data, that if you actually incorporate a lot of the indigenous trees, you'll have a higher percentage of bees which will visit these farms. And you can get a lot of, agriculture output out of this mixed form of agriculture. But to come back to our discussion as well, is how do we ensure, in terms of animal production, how do we ensure the indigenous, even cattle, the species? And an unfortunate thing on Africa, and I think in many parts of the developing world, is that we lose a lot of these unique biodiversity. So how do we document and how do you mainstream that into
Jerome,
the
what
actual
do you
practices?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Jerome, because you are looking at it from the European point of view, do you also see the same issues the European farmers are facing, what, for example, the farmers in Africa are facing?
I think there is a difference because most farmers in Europe are, I think, more intensive compared to African farmers. I've been also in Kenya, and there I saw other types of farmings. But to be honest, both farmers, they will see the effects of climate change in terms of less water or warmer seasons, etc. But relating to biodiversity, Worldwide Fund made a report in England a few years ago about what are the main drivers for biodiversity loss in the world. And that's for 60%, it's the food we eat, and mainly meat and dairy. So I think it's really, really important for the biodiversity all over the world that we should really consider our meat and dairy consumption and slow it down, because otherwise our future generations will not have much nature left. And it's not only the Amazon or other forests which are taken away for our animal feed, but it's also the indigenous nature which is destroyed by more and more production of animals.
Maybe quickly some statistics, to interrupt you here, because what you are saying, it's exactly what is right here, and I can give some statistics like that. Animal agriculture is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction. Oh. That livestock feed occupies 1/3 of the Earth's ice-free land. So we have so many animals there on our Earth, right? And it's not only that, right? If you look at how much water and food we are feeding to the animals, and like, this is why it's not only about CO2 emissions, it's about solving hunger problem today, right now. So we drink as humans 5.2 billion gallons of water and each day, and the animals are drinking 45 billion gallons. We are eating 21 billion pounds of food each day, and the animals 135 billion pounds of food. So we could easily feed all children who are suffering in this world today with this food, right?
Svetlana, there's no doubt that animal husbandry, the livestock, is directly linked to the destruction of the forest. We have seen how many acres have been removed in the Amazon for growing soya. So there's a direct link. And we also see the damage that the palm oil has been doing as well to some of the forests in the Southeast Asian countries as well. So these are some of the indicators that we have. But you have mentioned water. There is also the cost of invisible water, which is of course directly impacted through transportation, because we transport a lot of these soya across the world for feeding the animals. So that's one cost that we don't really factor in, is invisible water, and of course the energy that goes into transportation. But I mean, anyway, all the major corporations have done all the calculations, so we know the direct impact of the livestock industry on is directly linked to the clearance of many of the forests in South America, and of course in many other parts of the world as well. But if we look only at the consumption, so we also have to go back to the production. And I think one of the panelists has mentioned how we look at biodiversity the practices of agriculture in Africa, in Nairobi, in how it is all subsistence. So there is no one size fits all, because we have seen more intensive agriculture in developed countries, which are emitting, perhaps they're making more emission than those small farmers, the smallholder farmers out in Africa, in the poorer developed world, who may not be producing that much in terms of emission. And if we are going to apply a policy of the one size fits all in terms of taxation, then we also have to look at the impact it's going to have on them. Yeah. So it has to be done sectorally, it has to be done regionally, because there cannot be a one-size-fits-all, as when you see, for example, the World Bank comes up with a report taxing sugar. But again, we have to look at, you know, the segments of the population who are going to be directly impacted by increase the taxes of these food products. So yeah. These are some of my inputs. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so to make
you wanted to say something.
Yeah, we propose taxes on meat for the high-income countries who eat, and countries who eat the most meat. And this could also be countries like OECD countries, China, Russia. And China is, to be honest, they are eating more and more meat, and because they're in high numbers.
And fish, you know, let's not forget also about our oceans and fish. You know, there's 3/4 of our oceans are depleted. We can be fishless by 2048, some predictions. So, guys, it's really bad. So eating fish is the same as meat.
Mm. Yeah. I'd just like to add one other risk as well, which is quite of interest to a number of our investors, which is the antibiotic risk as well. So I think, as well as growing interest in biodiversity risk, we're also seeing this antibiotic resistance as an increasing problem too.
Maybe last point I add, Jerome. So when we fish 1 pound of fish out of the oceans, the 5 pounds of what we are fishing out are just animals which are killed. We don't want to fish them out, but we fish them out anyway, you know, because it comes together. So it's horrible, you know, it's just horrible.
Yeah.
And it's driven by consumption, it's driven by our eating habits.
Jerome already is in hot water with the agriculture. Now we drag him into fishery. So, sorry, Jerome, go ahead.
You were saying something. Yes.
Yeah, first we'd like to introduce taxes on meat and then dairy and then fish. I think we start with what is the main problem with food, and which has the highest risk on several aspects. And we didn't even mention our public health. Because in many countries, we eat 2 times more meat than is healthy for ourselves, for our own bodies. There are risk for diabetes 2, cancer, coronal cancer. And this is causing a lot of healthcare costs. And that's why, indeed, the World Bank last year warned all countries for overconsumption of sugar, but also overconsumption of meat. And they asked countries to consider taxes on unhealthy foods like sugar and meat, because also for low people with low incomes, they have to pay the healthcare costs for the ones who eat unhealthy. And this is causing too much, it's too expensive for all countries in the world when people eat unhealthy.
But there's another issue.
We need to revert. We need to make the crappy food more expensive and meat make it not attractive for people to eat and make it more attractive to eat vegetables, fruits, healthy right. foods, you know? Yeah. So we need yeah. to reverse it because people are, how to say, very comfortable and they don't like to change, especially if it's cheaper to eat something or they can afford it yeah. very simply, like Amina was mentioning.
It's healthy food as we know it, nutritious food is very much part and parcel of those who can afford it, those the rich
exactly. people. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The poor one, they will go for these high carb, high fat food because mm-hmm. it's cheaper. Right. Yeah. And one thing as well that has to be addressed is the issue of food waste. So you can mm-hmm. have all the best practices, but if something is not done to tackle food waste, right, because yeah. it is being said that from the farm to the fork, at least 40% of this goes to the waste bin. So this is something that has to be tackled. And I know among all the wasted foodstuff, there's plenty of meat, plenty of eggs, and all these that we have been saying in terms of loss of resources. And we're talking about climate. So this is another way of tackling climate is to address food waste.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the points was that we all are aware that the world population is increasing. That would mean also the food requirement is increasing. So what would be your advice on this? So it's to tackle this food production, to increase the food production as per the requirements of the increasing population.
Again, I can only speak for the South. I don't live in the North because I'm sure there are so many factors that go into this. I think what we have to do, at least for the South, is as I said, it is rain-fed. The infrastructure has been developed to ensure, massive, intensive farming. So ensure, the survival of these smallholder farmers who can make a difference, who can actually actively contribute to reducing greenhouse gas emission. And through proper education, through proper access to information, now that mobile technology is there, they can produce nutritious diet with indigenous, locally available crop at low cost. So with this approach, I think smallholder farmers, incentivizing them. And whatever taxation can be levied at the level of the country, if that country, for example, just embraces, for example, the World Bank report on taxing sugar. But how can that be redeployed to empower those small farmers to produce healthy stuff and ensure not just his livelihood, but the families, the region and the country or whatever place where he's practicing. And, he can be an enabler in terms of ensuring that quality produce is there and addressing food security as well at the same time.
Exactly. And Jerome, what would, because this is a point which is also valid for you, that the population is increasing. I mean, I was just reading Nigeria has now 1.2 billion, and in a couple of decades, they are going to be 2.5 billion. So mm-hmm. what would be your proposal for the EU?
There are really planetary boundaries for our food production. And when there will be more and more people, the available land is not increasing, but so we will have to have diets which are more and more plant-based, because this needs a few space to let it grow. So this is also why meat taxes are so important to really cut down meat consumption globally, or at least in the high-income countries, with 50% in 2030 or 2040. To enable food production for the rest of the world in the future. And there will be more mouths to feed. And we don't want to cut all the forest in the world. So we have to create space for new people coming on Earth.
So
we have to subsidize vegetables and fruits and plant-based meat to make it more attractive to buy it. And that also the low-income groups in every country can afford those kind of products, which are more healthy and more sustainable.
And Helena, incentive
for rooftop agriculture. I mean, this is also coming up. It's very fashionable nowadays. Permaculture, promote agroecology, agroforestry. restoration ecology and key line design, you know, and ensure a more holistic management of all the available resources that can be geared towards food production. So all these, I think, if people have access to the appropriate knowledge and the technology, which should be also available and affordable, I'm sure, you know, each individual can make a difference.
Exactly. And Helena, because you, from the investment point of view, how would you look at it?
Yeah, I think just speaking from what the investors are doing, I think it's really useful for the investors to engage with the companies that they're actually invested in. And our tools are being used, for example, the Protein Producer Index, which looks the wide range of ESG risks that these companies are exposed to. And so I think this kind of active management, engaging in some of the largest protein producer companies, will be a way which, you know, to actually reform them and ensure that those companies are reducing those really high sustainability risks. And another point is that we've already seen the investors using these type of tools, but I think we need to see also the public sector and government looking at these risks as well. So, you know, some of the major development banks and other actors could probably benefit from looking at this high-risk sector and the sustainability risks, and also the growth of sustainable protein, which will reduce a lot of the risks.
Yeah, I think the role of investors can be very important. Comparable with 10 years ago, then investors called governments, please introduce carbon taxes on fossil fuels. And then the governments did. But I think the next phase could be that also investors ask governments to, at least in the high income countries, to also start carbon prices on meat and dairy. And it could be excise duties per kilogram meat, so that beef will be more expensive compared to pork and chicken, to reflect the greenhouse gas emissions, and that we also have to pay a CO2 price for meat per kilogram. So that would mean a price of say 50 to 90 euro per ton CO2 equivalents per kilogram meat. Mm-hmm. And that will make it more expensive, but I think it's a level playing field with fossil fuels. Both products, meat and fossil fuels, create greenhouse gas emissions. And why is meat so cheap in the supermarkets? We have to tax it, really.
No, I completely agree to that. But just on going a bit detail into your investor issue, and that is what I would also like to ask Helena, that the European government or the policymakers, they're all going for the Paris Agreement, the goals of the Paris Agreement. But the investors, unfortunately, are not always. If you look at look at your pension funds in Netherlands, they are one of the biggest investors in the deforestation in the Amazon. They should also be brought under control. And I think, Helena, maybe, I don't know if your members also consist of pension funds and institutions like that. Are you also?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the specific example that you mentioned, but a number of our members are actually committing to the climate change goals, and a lot of them are actually making net zero commitments as well. So we are seeing a sort of growing trend towards that. And that is, I think, positive for addressing a lot of these, you know, sustainability risks that we see.
There is the risk issue. It is so important, especially as we're talking Paris, we're talking about climate change, and this risk has to be flagged in, because crops can be decimated with the flooding or drought. And I think there is something, another tool that can be flagged into this picture if we are going to be addressing, well, again, I will use a very strong word, less hypocrisy, traceability. So that people are, you know, walking the talk and not just making all these beautiful speeches, and behind it's exactly the opposite which is happening. And I think this is something that people are getting very tired with, right? So let us walk the talk in terms of addressing sustainability issues, in terms of addressing risk as well, because this is something that has to be flagged in any model that we are going to build, because it is becoming very much an issue. We have seen what happened in Australia with the fires. And then immediately after a few months, we saw the flooding as well. So agriculture is going to be very badly impacted. And then if you're going to leverage the tax, it's such a way that access to this foodstuff will not be there, then all the discussion we're having will just be tantamount to nothing. Exactly. So we have to be very, very impacted practical and very realistic about this.
Exactly. Yeah. Action is so important, guys, you know, and some countries like New Zealand are already doing it. They say, like, New Zealand, they want to implement, or it will be implemented, the meat tax in 2025 within their trading system of for CO2 emission trade. So, Jerome, for you, the question, when do you think, if the tax meat will be indeed accepted, by when we can see that, by when the prices will rise for meat, here in Europe, at least?
Yes, I expect
that with Netherlands.
Well, Germany maybe might be the first country with a real tax on meat. Their government.
Yeah, you're taking the richest country of Europe.
But to be honest, Spain already decided in 2012 to increase the VAT tax on meat to increase it to 8% and or from 8% to 10%, and then in the same time they reduced taxes on vegetables and fruits to 4%. So this is an example of a country already did so. But in the Netherlands, there's a new government, and we hope that in their new government agreement, also meat tax will be there, because the second largest party, the Liberal D66, they really want to have tax on meat introduced in the Netherlands too. So maybe we are the first, but I think it will be there in 2023 or 2024 at the earliest. So we have to make the preparations, etc. So we have to be patient, but it can be there.
You go first?
I mean, for me, you know, guys, how I feel, to be honest, I mean, we are discussing things, yes, tax meat, but it's still like a treatment of not a disease, but treatment of symptoms. We all are aware. Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, and it's a bit direct, you know. We all are aware of what's happening, and still we are closing our eyes on what's happening, you know. And this is also not about, we can feed people with the food we are producing to animals. Correct, we can stop deforestation, we can stop biodiversity loss very quickly if we would like to. But it's also about, as humans, you know, it's a holocaust against animals what we are doing.
I'll just quickly respond to this, Svetlana. You know, this is exactly what's happening, because you mentioned the ocean. Right now we have in the Indian Ocean one species of tuna which is very heavily threatened. It's the yellowfin tuna. And we know the yellowfin tuna is harvested in our waters, and it goes to appropriate market. I'm not going to cite any company or any country by name, but we know that the entire structure, and we know that consumers have a big role to play in ensuring the survival of that species there. I'll tell you how. The consumer has to demand the traceability of the tuna they're purchasing in the supermarket. And they can make a very big difference. They can make a difference to the policymakers if they stop buying the tuna, for example, which is coming from the Indian Ocean, because they have to ensure the sustainable fishing of that particular species. Right? So this is what we have to, and I think now technology is available. We have blockchain, for example, that can easily make it happen. We just use, you know, the QR code, we can scan, we can get the information. So this is how we will mobilize policymakers, because we can have all these lofty ideas and great conversation, but when it comes to implementation, I mean, this is where it all stalls. So if we want to make a difference, as I said, we have to empower the consumer. They have to demand from the policymakers, from their government, what they're doing about it. The same is true for beef, the same is true for chicken, the same is true for fish, the same is true for climate change. We have the power to make a difference. But unfortunately, many parts of the world, you know, the population is unempowered, and of course there are all sorts of autocratic governments that impose a lot of restrictions on citizens. But as a movement, we should be able to make a difference if we are serious about it.
Exactly.
I agree to that, Amina. And, you know, I think the problem is also that as a consumer, when you go to supermarket to buy your meat or fish, you are completely disconnected. You don't see the lively creature there, you know. So people don't realize. if they would need to kill their own fish or own lamb there and very fresh one, you know, there is a video from vegan movement produced that the couple comes to supermarket and a man takes a frozen lamb and shows, yeah, for dinner, and she said, no, let's take a fresh one. And then they come to the meat up telling the department, and they ask, yeah, please, a fresh one. And then the guy comes out with a lovely living animal, the lamb, a baby one, you know, and he gives it to the lady. Okay, very fresh one. How do you want me to kill it? And the lady has such eyes, and you know, and then, okay, you realize actually for this, you need to kill this animal. So we are disconnected from fish. Tuna fish is just a piece of red thing, you know, and so we need to show it somehow to people that what you're doing, you know, this disconnection is happening.
Yes. Yeah? I think indeed that transparency at the supermarket level is very important. And this can be done by maybe labeling, where you label the environmental impact of food products with A, B, G, D, G, etc., so that you can see that meat is the worst.
Like in the car. Yeah.
And there's a supermarket in Germany, it's called Penny's, it's part of Rewe. And there in Berlin, and there you can see on the shelves of the where the food products are sold, what is the true price of the food. So you see the normal price, but you see also, maybe we can show sheet two. There you can see an example of how it's done for cheese. So you see it costs $1.99, but the true cost, including the environmental cost, like greenhouse gases and nitrogen, then it would be much more expensive. And I think this is an example of what governments could do to make those kinds of transparencies obliged for supermarkets, that people are aware that there are more costs than you pay in the supermarket. That could be a start.
Mm-hmm. If I could add a point to that as well, I think the points being raised are very important on the importance of transparency and disclosure of information. And it's not only important for the consumers, I think it's very important for investors as well. One of the things we found is actually in our fair research, unfortunately, over 80% of the largest meat and dairy companies are not disclosing any emission target on climate emissions, for example. So I think that's just an example where there's a lack of disclosure, and it's something that would be very helpful for investors too, to have that information about the companies. And it's something that policymakers as well could actually support in terms of better disclosure and greater transparency.
So what would you recommend, Elena, to big investors having billions and they still invested maybe in meat companies such as GBS or Cargill, you know, what would you say to them?
Because
how should they be involved?
Yeah, it can end up also as a stranded asset. So what would you...
Yeah, one thing I would suggest is actually to look at the information there, and for those investors to look at, for example, the index that we have, or the protein producer index and the climate risk tool, and they can look at the risk exposure of those companies, and they can also engage with portfolio companies to improve their practices. And some of the major companies are responding well to the types of engagement from investors. So I think that's a really important tool as well to recognize.
But the thing is that who actually takes them to task when they default?
Yeah, exactly. Why do you take that's them? The point. I mean, it is what you, Helen, what you said is correct, but also what Amina said is also true. Because, for example, we are aware since quite a long time that companies like JBS or Cargill is what they're doing in the Amazon forest. But still, yet, the investors are investing in it heavily. So that means there is some kind of delink that people are aware of it, but still they somehow choose to invest. Like I mentioned, the Dutch pension funds are still going on investing in there.
Yeah, I'd say there has been some cases where people will pull their investment away as well, where there's particularly high risk. But in general, some of these companies are improving in their performance. But it's also a case that we need the right regulation there as well to ensure that those type of risks actually don't take place. So it's a bit of a combination needed, really.
Exactly.
I mean, your members, Helena, manage 38. You manage 38 trillion US dollars, right? So it's common assets. Of your
no, that's the membership of the member organization. We're a member organization. Yeah,
there are some Dutch sustainable banks who say we don't invest in unsustainable agriculture. So you can also decide not to be active in this. You can disclose, like you can say we don't invest in coal mining or etc. So it's maybe comparable. And then, yeah. But you, of course, engaging with such companies would also be a good thing. But then you should really ask for reduction goals for CO2 emissions, etc. And working also together on calls to action to governments to have taxes on meat. Shell was, for instance, a company who said as one of the first in its sector, please governments. Introduce CO2 taxes for the whole sector. And there could be also a company like GBS or another meat company who can say, please introduce meat taxes because this will help the world. And when it's a level playing field, then also there is no disadvantage compared to competitors. So why not?
I'm very curious when they are going to come back
in the meat sector.
Helena, one question for you, because you are from the FIRE initiative. You published a report on livestock levies, and it's an updated report about the impact of future meat tax. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, so that was actually a report we brought out last year, which looked at the topic of the livestock levy. And that report showed that there is a lot of growing momentum towards internalizing the costs of livestock production into the sector. And actually, we covered the kind of proposals that have gone ahead in the policy space so far. There has been proposals for some form of meat tax in a number of countries so far. I think, as Drew mentioned, Germany, Sweden, Denmark, New Zealand, Netherlands, and several others. And there are some interesting parallels, I think, with other sectors where there's been an increasing kind of amount of taxation and regulation taking place. For example, the tobacco sector. So, that was quite an interesting report for investors, for their information in terms of the direction of travel for this sector.
I mean, my personal opinion is there seems to be a kind of misconnection. So, one side, you have Jerome speaking on behalf of EU with the tax on the meat, tax on dairy. But on the other side, Amina is mentioning that you can't have one thing that fits all. You also have to have different kind of thing, and especially when you're talking about the smallhold farmers or the little farmers in Africa. So is there a kind of way that people can come in between? And Helena, you have the kind of global coverage from the investor's point of view. So you have one side the government's point of view or what the governments can do. And
basically,
one side
the question is simple. How can we unite forces to make it happen and that some meaningful action comes that the farmers in Africa wouldn't be harmed by that, but would be benefiting from those policies, right? Yeah. And that investors would put their money where their mouth is. So what they think is good to do for the world, that they would put the money there and that the policymakers would support.
And especially with the climate change, because then we really look at countries like Mauritius, which is an island state, is going to be severely impacted by the sea level rise.
So Ben, we need very strong institution. We need a very, very lively multilateral system that will address all this issue that we're talking about. And I think over the past few years, we have seen that missing on the international scene. And we have seen everybody pulling from all sides and they are not looking at the global commons. Mm-hmm. And if you don't protect the global common, it is never going to produce a world that will be fair for all. And as I said, again, I caveat what I'm saying, because we are emerging out of the COVID, where we're going to see enormous amount of inequality right across the world. And it's already happening. We have seen, for example, how some countries, some companies have become so rich over the past 12 months, and how some countries are going to be poorer. And we have seen the incentives that the richer countries are giving to all the institutions, as opposed to what poorer countries can provide. So if we are going to look at a world that is going to accommodate about 7 billion people, 9 billion people by 2050, so what kind of policies are we going to be putting on the table, which will address some form of fairness and some form of, reducing the gap? But I don't see that happening. So I'm not going to sound like a pessimist, but I think I'm going to be sounding more like a realist as we move ahead. So this is where we need very strong leadership.
Yeah, would you say then that each country should solve it on their own, or how do you see that?
I'm not saying that we can't. I mean, these global issues require global solutions.
We can't do that alone.
Yeah. No, we can't do it alone. We can't do it alone. We need the support. We need, of course, the leadership, as I said, of the big players, because they can make a difference. They have the weight. They have the, they have the gravitas to be able to do that. We need that because it's a global issue. We need global solution. We need global actors. Climate change, for example, will never be able to tackle by, piecemeal or individual. It has to be done at the global level. So at the global level, what kind of resources do we put in play? What leaders are going to be there to address the cause for one and all? And what kind of policies do we actually enact? And also, how, as I said earlier on, how do we take them to task when they're not delivering? We have seen this about the revival of the WTO, but that institution has a huge task ahead to act, to do its job as it should. So this is where we need to have a global solidarity to be able to address these global issues. It's never going to happen individually.
And what about the UN climate summits in Glasgow, or the UN food system summit, or the biodiversity summit? I think countries could make agreements or announce that they will work towards those solutions for the too high impacts of meat or dairy. I think that are the places on the earth where governments can make agreements and of course investors can make also calls to actions on carbon taxes on food, of course.
Jerome, we increasingly have to put our money where our mouth is. We can make all kind of resolution, but if we don't put that, in fact, in about 9 years' time, we're going to be assessed on the SDGs. Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, but I don't see ourselves getting anywhere near the deliverables. Yeah. How do we do that? And unfortunately, there is only one country that has been able to deliver at least on one. It's to get people out of absolute poverty. It is not perceived to be a good player right now, but I think China has a lot to say in terms of with removing millions out of absolute poverty, right? It's the only country that's done that. It's done that by just looking internal. But this is not what we want to do. We want to actually lift people out of poverty globally. But how do we do that without a multilateral system that delivers for one and all?
Exactly.
Yeah, and Elena, do you want to comment on that? So,
yeah, I think I just wanted to make a point actually about sort of how to emerge stronger from this crisis that we're in right now. And I think what we've seen and we've learned, one of the things is that it's, prevention is better than cure. Prevention is also cheaper than cure as well. So we need to start tackling these risks early, such as climate change and also the emerging pandemic risk and antibiotic resistance and other challenges. A lot of these are also linked to the food system. And just from an investor perspective as well, investors need to see more policy certainty on what's happening and also better disclosure of information as well. We do need to see early action on issues such as climate change, because if the action is delayed, then we're really going to see these risks are unmanageable and there's going to be a lot of, system ecosystem collapse as well.
Exactly. And that's where I think I can, the next question should be, because more food, like we mentioned earlier, Jerome also said we don't have the land left anymore to have increased, keep on going more and more land for the
same diet is impossible.
So that would mean deforestation, destruction, further destruction of biodiversity of anyway, most of it is anyway already gone. So for what is the relation between global biodiversity loss and meat and dairy consumption? Do you guys have any kind of ideas how this can be kind of brought together?
I think, yeah, if we talk about biodiversity loss, Ben, is we are chopping the branch on which we're standing.
Yeah.
Because we are very much part of the ecosystem. And as I've said before, and I will sound like a broken record, is that we are part of the ecosystem and our survival is underpinned precisely by the protection of the biodiversity. And the way we are behaving, the way we are consuming is as if we have four planets. There is only one.
Yeah.
And I think every year we offshoot the consumption every year, at least by now we have probably consumed for 2021 already. So this is what we have to do is relook at our resources. We know we cannot have infinite growth with finite resources. And and this is something that we have to keep on reminding policymakers. We also have to keep on reminding investors, because very often their vision, of course, is to reap maximum benefit on the investment, but it is not possible to think in that linear manner anymore. We really have to sit down and have a conversation on this.
But I think still, you know, we are always pointing at someone we need to remind. But guys, really, why don't you start also with yourself and just stop eating meat and drink milk, eating eggs, eating fish? No, that is an action. Right?
Let us all be convinced.
And you can, because you are the heads of such big networks, you know, big networks, companies. You could be an example. You could share it on LinkedIn or wherever and say, hey, now I become vegan. Do you? Yes. Are you? And why? You know, put some reason. And I'm sure this is spreading awareness and education.
I'm going to disappear from here.
Come back. I need your support.
So friends, we'll have to quote Gandhi, be the change you want to see in the world. Huh?
Yeah, yes, exactly. This is what I'm talking about. And you are all very powerful consumers and most importantly, leaders, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Now I disappear. Okay.
Yeah. Maybe to say how important this call to action is, that there was a calculation made that in the Netherlands, when we would eat just a little bit less meat and dairy, the CO2 emission reduction is comparable when making all buildings climate neutral. And but our government is putting millions and millions and billions of euros into making our homes and buildings climate neutral, but just one meat tax delivers the same results.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of money to invest back into the sustainable farming. It gives money to make vegetables and fruits cheaper by subsidizing it or fiscal subsidies. And we can compensate low-income groups when meat will become more expensive. So I think it's no problem.
That's exactly. I mean, Netherlands is a very good country for disconnection. Everybody is aware of this, about the advantages of sustainable farming or sustainable agriculture. But still, if you look even in Netherlands, how much percentage of the food you are buying in the market and everything is really from sustainable? It is something around 3 or 4%.
No,
so kind of disconnection.
Yes, but when we organized a lot of consumer inquiries in Netherlands, Germany, and France, and 60 to 80% of the consumers support our proposals. But so we only need politicians who recognize that their own voters, they want them to introduce such measures, and I hope that OCTEP Coalition is supported more and more by other companies and NGOs who think yes, this is a good step forward, and then we can
but then,
stronger.
But then I have a bit of outrageous theory is that our democratic structures, okay, that's my personal opinion, in Europe is not functioning for its citizens. It is functioning for a very small lobby group. Mm-hmm. And where you have this big farming industries or the farmers, majority of the, you yourself mentioned, majority of the consumers want this, but still it is not happening. And politicians will always choose.
But you know, Ben, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is exactly what's been happening over the past few years. And if you look at the percentage of we know, there is now this very infamous saying that the 1% can no longer dictate for the 99%.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So there has to be, at the end of the day, that's what I always say as well, is that you should never have anybody with their back against the wall because they have nothing to lose. And those who have, so they have to be very, very careful because you cannot compete with an empty stomach. And these people, they will have nothing to lose and they become unaccountable to anything. So these are some of the, I think, the discussion that we need to have. But one thing I would like to say to Jerome is that the Netherlands has done a great job with agriculture and with water as well. So you have been a champion in that. I think we have learned quite a bit from you. So you've done a great job. But we're not very happy with our dodo, though.
Jerome, did you know that the country name Mauritius also comes from the Dutch?
Yes, I know. It's from France, I think, who visited Mauritius, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Guys, we have just 5 minutes left, and I'd like to have like final remarks from your side. What would you like to say to our audience? Maybe call to action. How do you see? How can we engage people from different industries, different stakeholders? You know, so
and policymakers
and policymakers, of course. Yes.
So, Amina, you go ahead.
Yeah. I think this battle or this war can be won. It can be won if we all come together. We all come together as a community of humans with one aim, and that aim is to preserve the planet. That's a very lofty goal. But it can be done when we show greater solidarity and, of course, through institutions that are there to help. But definitely it can be won. Because it must be one, because as I said, we only have one planet. But addressing taxation, addressing subsidy, calls for a better redistribution and more empowerment of those that can make a difference eventually to the cause. So I think what we have shown today, I think the debate is where the shortcomings are, but where the plus points are, and that's perhaps more important.
Exactly. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Amina. Thank you.
And Helena?
Yeah, so I'd like to sort of bring a call to action to any investors that are watching the show to really take a look at our sort of website. You're welcome to join the FAIR Network and also start to engage with the companies about ESG risks. So particularly in the protein sector, as has been mentioned on this call, we've got a range of different tools like the Protein Index, which would help investors to actually manage those growing risks. So that's the first thing. And then for policymakers, I think what the investors are calling for here is actually greater certainty to actually manage a lot of these long-term sustainability risks that are really a threat to all of us, as well as to the investments and to the kind of global capital markets as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lena.
And Jerome, concluding remark.
Yes. So my call to actions to you would be have a look at our website tapcoalition.eu with double P from its tap from True Animal Protein Price Coalition, and you can subscribe our newsletter to be informed. Companies or investors can become our partners. We already have companies like Beyond Meat, Corn, a lot of food companies and others. We have NGOs as partners, so please welcome. And policymakers, yes, I think I made my point clear that it's really important to shift dietary patterns towards less meat, and that we really need policy proposals from you to make it happen.
And do our viewers have to learn Dutch to understand your reports?
No, it's in English.
Thank you, guys. I mean, big applause you. To you, yeah, exactly. For taking this challenge about vegan or vegetarian diet. So thanks for passing the exam.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and have a nice weekend.
And have a good dinner. Or breakfast.
Thanks.
Without me.
Bye.
Okay.
Well, so it was really good discussion, I think. Tough, right? But I think it's very important.
Exactly. And I think the concluding remark of the three guests was amazing. And I think this is really makes a sport. So... you go ahead or I?
You can go ahead.
Okay, so our next week, today you saw the show, it was on agriculture. Next week, we'll be back again with a very hot topic at this moment, and that is renewable energy. So we have an example of a very successful project and with a very powerful investor exactly in this topic. So very much looking forward to discussion on that topic. And this is... not only renewable energy is not only the sector which is going through very rapid transformation, but it's also one of the major investments, whether you are talking about the European Investment Bank or other institutions, there's a huge amount of funds being available for this sector. So yes.
Don't forget to join us next Friday about that. Yeah, and a little reminder about the course on 20th of May. So join us on chamomile.ch at events. Register for the course. We have some spots left, but we don't accept hundreds of people to make it profitable, good for you and beneficial for you. So don't miss that one. And I'm still impressed by our guest, you know, very knowledgeable and very inspiring. So if we can unite our forces, I think for sure we can win the war, like Amina has said. So act with impact, I guess.
Exactly. And I was thinking maybe you should offer or you should invite the FAIR Initiative and TAP Coalition into Chamomile.
Of course. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So everyone who visits this show becomes our honor member of chamomile.ch and can spread the word about the initiatives where they are in. And this is how we'd like to unite the whole community to achieve sustainable development goals. We just have 9 years left.
Exactly.
So act with impact.
Like Dr. Amina said. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjee. I'm Svetlana.
And I'm Ben.
In season 2, we will be traveling around the globe, out of Switzerland, and bring amazing leaders from businesses, thought leaders, political leaders, of course, investors and experts.
We're working at implementing and realizing all the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, better known as SDGs.
And they're also making profit.
Hello, I am Amina Gurifakim, and I'm the sixth president of the Republic of Mauritius.
My name is Parvati, and I'm a musical artist and the founder and CEO of Parvati Foundation.
I'm Amisha Abhishekhusai. I'm an entrepreneur here in Abhishekhusai. I'm running, on one side, financial services, a company.
You know, hundreds of deals a month, we are seeing more things happening in this impact world. And this is because, look, the world is changing.
So join us to discover impact investing ecosystem.
See you every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central European time at Swiss Impact with Benefits.
See you on Friday. Act with impact.